I'm Helen Avery with the Green Finance Institute, and thank you so much for joining us today to this podcast slash interview that's part of our farming toolkit. You're probably all familiar with the toolkit, and that's how you got here today. But if you aren't, the toolkit is basically designed for farmers in England to understand better what nature markets are available to them, like biodiversity, net gain, carbon, nutrient neutrality, and then to walk them through how they might start interacting with those nature markets and what they can learn from farmers who've already made that journey through case studies. And as part of that, we're providing these audios and interviews just to help farmers out a little bit more in digesting what can be quite complex information. And today I'm pleased to say that I'll be joined by Archie Ruggles-Brise. He is the estate manager with Spains Hall Estate in Essex, who has been designing some biodiversity net gain projects ready for sale when that kicks in through legislation later this year. And he's going to be walking us through how they've made some of those decisions, how they've looked at the costing and budget in particular, some of the risk management issues, and then general tips for farmers as they or you are thinking about how to or whether to access some of these nature markets. So with that, I will invite Archie on. Good afternoon, Archie. It's lovely to see you, hear you. How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you.
Good. And thank you for joining us today. So I've given a little bit of a preamble about who you are, but I wondered if you could share us a bit of background about your role, about Spains Hall Estate, the type of land that you're managing, the size, everything that a fellow farmer might want to know.
Yeah, so it's great to be able to share this with this audience. So we are a farming estate in northwest Essex, on the border of Essex, Suffolk and Cambridgeshire pretty much. We are very conventional. I mean, I've described our estate as bog standard. So it's 2,000 acres of broadly clay-based, fairly heavy land, grade two, grade three agricultural land. We're in the uplands of a river catchment, as much as you can be up anything in Essex. And so, you know, conventional arable land until I started making some changes. So really, anyone, particularly in the east of England, would recognise us as being a very conventional looking farm.
And I'm from Essex myself, so I understand how lacking in hills we are in that area of the world. So tell us, you've obviously been looking at biodiversity net gain, and we'll talk about that in more detail today and really sort of get to the nubbins of how you built that business model around it and how you've been looking at budget and risk management. But can you sort of start off by telling us, you know, what was it that made you begin that journey in looking into biodiversity net gain, or generally sort of nature markets, as we now call them?
Yeah, it's a really good question, because it's essentially a looking at things in a different way. So my background, whilst I'm the 11th generation of my family to be lucky enough to be custodians of this land, my career to date has gone through the environmental sector and started off in the water industry, and I did a biology degree. So the kind of natural environment is my comfortable place. That's where I like to be. And through those two different industries and through running this farm now for almost 15 years, we've been looking at things and thinking, something needs to change. We can see a great deal of risk accumulating around the things that we do. We see ourselves and our neighbours, you know, really subject to volatility, price changes, atmospheric changes, climatic changes, things that we have no control over. And one of the things that I really wanted to try and do was wrestle back some of that control. And coming at it from an environmental perspective was a sort of natural thing for me. So the thing that unifies all the approach here is water, because that's my sort of comfortable place. I used to work for the Rivers Trust movement, so rivers and catchment management. And the great thing about water is it ties together almost all of the elements you do on farm, be it either built or natural. And also, it really is a very quick way to be able to look at any system and be able to pick out some things that either need changing or where risk is accumulating. So quality of water is deteriorating, or the amount of things that live in the rivers, you know, or just there isn't as much water as there would be at some times of year, and there is much more water at other times of year. So it's a really stark choice. So really, that's the reason why we're trying to do something different. I'm trying to do something different, is because it's very obvious when you look at our land through a lens of that particular resource that just business as usual is not going to work.
And did that sort of tie into sort of thinking through also reduction in BPS and having to attract private sector finance, to what extent did this sort of bringing private sector finance in play a role in some of the decisions you've made around your land?
It's an interesting question, because I started looking at this long before the new agricultural policy was even mooted. Although, to be fair, since that has happened, since Brexit has happened, and we have been in a position where essentially we've been able to start with a blank sheet of paper, that in itself is an opportunity, but also the challenges. So some of the challenges that you mentioned there, things like BPS going, have been the sort of sharp stick that has pointed us, you know, just come on, get on with it. You need to do something. You can't just sort of sit around and sort of mull it over for a decade and wonder whether you're going to make any changes. You actually, it is a bit of a cliff edge for some people, mm-hmm. less so for us, because we have most of our land rented out, but certainly for our tenants, it can be. So, you know, that can be the instigator of change. In terms of private finance, the ecosystem approach is where I come at this. And the ecosystem approach was sort of first articulated in the early 2000s, when private investment in nature was beyond philanthropy, you know, grant making, really non-existent, you know, prior to the carbon markets or anything like that. So in terms of designing the system around private finance, that was something that became more and more a component as we went on. But in terms of the initial sort of feature of it, it wasn't there initially, but it is very heavily there now.
Mm. Well, so moving on to that, you've chosen to sell biodiversity net gain units, and that's sort of the market, if you will, that you're operating in predominantly. Can you talk us through, you know, how that's been, what's been your experience, why biodiversity net gain?
So we did an initial natural capital assessment back in 2019, and that highlighted this new, at that point, sort of very new kind of emerging policy of biodiversity net gain, and this sort of concept of these units that you could create from doing something different with your land. And I'll be honest, you know, coming from a sort of watery background, things like that, the sort of ecology side of things is something that I'm not so well versed in. But then immediately we looked at it, thinking, actually, this is not only a potentially significant revenue stream, and I'll be honest, that's, you know, that was one of the early sort of flags, but it's also a way of securing long-term funding to underpin the sort of changes that I wanted to make anyway. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that has been a really powerful motivator to enable the change, because until you can start seeing some way that actually you can make this pay the bills, it's very hard to dedicate enough time and effort to really starting to think about doing things differently.
Yeah. So what are the types of interventions that you have been making, or where are you in the process as well?
So we, a few years ago, we released beavers onto the estate as part of a natural flood management project. And that was sort of way, way in advance. This was 2018. So this was prior to the natural capital appraisal. It was to try and do what we could to sort out a localized problem. So our local village floods periodically, very small, never going to get statutory money. So we decided to try and do something. Well, I decided to try and do something about it. And in order to try and do that, I was drawn to a combined approach between a man-made natural flood management and beavers. And the beavers were sort of, you know, part experiment, part marketing tool, part just generally quite interesting, and looked like they might do some quite cool stuff. But that was the sort of the impetus for it. And then we moved on to trying to integrate that into a, use that as the sort of key service to try and integrate into a wider land use change concept, which is what we're doing at the moment.
So does that entail taking land out of production and for flood purposes or wetlands? Talk us through what you're doing on the land.
So in the areas that where the beavers are operating, then that is definitely land out of production. Although, to be fair, most of the land that they are operating on is not really in production anyway. So, you know, we've got one enclosure that's a woodland, and it was a pretty poor woodland in terms of timber. Great for biodiversity, even better for biodiversity now, but, you know, rubbish for producing timber. The other areas are things that had already been taken out of arable production and put into government stewardship schemes because they weren't profitable, or they were very difficult to farm, or they were very wet, so we're making them wetter. So for us, the whole thing is about picking the right intervention in the right place. So we haven't designed a BNG scheme for BNG's sake. We have put BNG into the mix of the possible interventions alongside countryside stewardship, agri-environment schemes, woodland creation, hedgerow replanting and restoration. All, everything we're doing fits into what we call the ecological master plan. And we, within that sort of area, which covers about 500 hectares of the farm, we have tried to pick the most appropriate intervention and then found the way to fund it. So rather than designing the scheme to say, we want a BNG enterprise, we have designed the scheme to fit the environment and fit the farming system that we want, and then gone, and that bit fits with BNG and this bit doesn't.
Yeah, it's incredible. And if anyone listening has not been to Spain's Hall Estate, you can go and see the beavers. You can book a tour. We did it ourselves. And it's a very charming village that you're near as well, Finchingfield. Out of interest, what has been the impact on flood reduction? You know, we're all talking about flood this time of year, as we always do. It would be great to sort of hear some of the positive impacts of the work you've been doing.
So from a flooding perspective, it's almost impossible to be categorical on the impact. But we know that we store more water now than we did before we started doing anything. The land is wetter for longer than it was previously. And we also know that since we have, the beavers have been in place and the leaky dams we put in have been in place, that the village or the properties in the village that used to flood haven't flooded. Now, I'm not going to be the one to say that that's because of us.
Yeah.
I'm also never going to be the one that will guarantee, no flood risk management can guarantee, but we think that we are increasing the resilience of the village. And in doing that, we are also building back biodiversity, we're sequestering carbon, and we're doing all these other things that are hopefully beneficial to everybody and including us in the long term.
And I'm sure bringing in some tourists as well, as everyone wants to hang out with the beavers. So I think you've estimated that the development costs specifically for the BNG units creation was about £1,000 to £1,500 a hectare. Can you just talk about what those costs include?
Yeah, so it, for us, because we're sort of slightly early adopters for this, I dare say our costs may be slightly different to those that maybe you may be able to get it cheaper now, I don't know. But, you know, everything we had to do, the main cost comes from doing a proper ecological baseline. This is boots on the ground stuff. We have also used remote sensing and tech where possible. But really, it comes down to having somebody who knows what they're talking about, walking around the farm going, this is what's currently here. This is what could be here. This is the sort of appropriate target habitat. This is the difficulties you're going to face in doing that. So the majority of the cost in that. But there is also things like building a GIS system in order to house this information, because none of your off-the-shelf farming GIS systems are really designed to cope with this. There is also, you know, other costs around things like legal advice, tax advice, trying to attend as many events as you possibly can in order to work out what on earth this new policy is all about and how you do it. And, you know, bidding for funds takes time, brings in some money sometimes if you're lucky. But, you know, so all in, we estimate it's about 1,000 to 1,500. But as I say, that's for our scale of project.
Mm. And you were one of the BNG pilots, weren't you? So you were able to tap into some of the early public sector funding.
That's right. I think we were one of 80 applicants to the Natural England Biodiversity Net Gain Credits pilot. So the sort of pilot for the sort of highest level of or most distant level of mitigation that's available under BNG. And we were lucky enough. I think initially there were 9 projects. I think there are 5 now at the sort of tail end of that, and of which we've been there through the whole thing. So that's been game changing for us. Absolutely game changing.
So in terms of locating buyers for the units, just talk us through what's that process been like?
Well, it's still very much ongoing. So if any of those people listening, you know, if you're in the market for units, then just look us up. It's very interesting because a lot of the potential buyers aren't necessarily keyed into what they need. It's a new policy. It hasn't become mandatory at the time of recording, and it will do fairly shortly. So it's a very ad hoc approach, and we're trying everything. So we're working in the voluntary market from, you know, the very high level financial institutions that obviously GFI are very familiar with. I'm happy to talk to any of those, and we have been talking to some of them to try and understand what they need and what they want or what they think they might want, right down to individual developers who have a small site that maybe requires a, you know, small handful of units because they have either been asked to or have voluntarily adopted pre-mandatory BNG conditions, and everything in between. So our approach is to talk to everybody and to talk to every sort of supporting agency for those developers, particularly on the mandatory side, because there is no clear route to market for this. There's lots of people playing in the intermediary space, but as yet, it's still a very fluid environment, and there's no kind of accepted best way, only way you know, accredited way of bringing this sort of thing to market?
Yeah, so this might be a sort of more challenging question then to pin down an answer to, but are you seeing differences in some of the conversations you're having on whether some developers or buyers, maybe even, you know, as you say, through voluntary means, are looking to pay up front or pay later? Are some prepared to pay more? Is there pricing being discussed that seems pretty much in line among everyone, or is it all over the spectrum? And if so, how are you managing that?
It is very difficult to answer that at the moment. I mean, we have had, it's probably fair to say that the majority of deals that we're discussing at the moment are focused around a lump sum. So they are a lump sum that will discharge a development condition under a planning condition. So that's one approach, but that's not the only one. So we have had some others that are discussions around a more phased financial approach. In the voluntary market, it really is all of those and more. So as a project developer, it's very challenging to price because cost is linked very much to scale. Because if you've got a big area of a habitat, or you've got a big area which you can dedicate to this, it can then sometimes be much more costly to fence, for example, or it can be less costly to manage. So, you know, and if you get somebody that comes to you and says, okay, I only want a few units, which equates to a relatively small area of land, you've got to kit yourself up to manage that habitat for that very small area of land, which makes it incrementally far more expensive than if you were doing it over the whole piece. So it's a very difficult pricing model at the moment.
Have you been able to even understand the number of units that you might be able to produce? And what's it like using the biodiversity metric as well? It's really intrigued.
Yeah, so because we've been doing this a few years, we've gone through, I think we're now on the fourth different version of the biodiversity metric. And it takes hours to convert from one to the other. And, you know, less so recently because the metric version changes have been less significant. But certainly, I mean, changing it from version 2 to 3.1, for example, was a complete nightmare and changed the number of units that we could theoretically yield, you know, massively. The other thing to throw into the coin is we do have a very good idea as to the quantum of units now, partly because the metric versioning is hopefully set, so we can work it out what it is for the Secretary of State's metric, and we won't have to hopefully do that again for a while. But it is also related to where the offset site is. So, you know, there is an interplay between the sort of unknown piece of who you're selling it to until you sell it and what are you doing. But then also time plays a factor. So we've started creating some of the habitats already, and for others, we're holding off until we've got a deal. And the metric treats those two situations differently.
Oh, really?
The temporal multiplier. Yeah. So if you create it in advance and you've got, it's 2 years in advance, you get a sort of credit within the metric multiplier, which means that you get more units per unit area than you would do if you started on day one when you had a deal. The other thing is just time means that the land changes. You know, you're constantly having to re-baseline. So, you know, if anyone listening to this is thinking, we'll just do one baseline and then we'll sit on it for 5 years to see. It's not going to work like that. So you will have to be on it and you will have to understand what your land is actually doing at the time, or you continue to farm it, which keeps it at a certain baseline. So, you know, there's different ways of doing things.
So any advice to farmers then on how they sort of begin to create a budget for, you know, these development costs for habitat creation for BNG?
I think the easiest way to create the sort of investment readiness costs, so the sort of non-operational cost side of things, is just to talk to your professional advisors, because increasingly they will have an idea as to how much it's going to take to, you know, put together a precedent contract or advise you on the tax implications, because your position is going to be different to mine, which is going to be different to the next person. So, you know, that is something that you need bespoke advice on. There's no getting away from that. In terms of building an operational budget, I think farmers are fairly well placed to do that. In some cases, much better placed than others. There's a lot of sources of advice you can use out there if there are operations that you're not familiar with. Things like John Nix and the Agricultural Budgeting and Costings book, the ABC, has some information in it. But what's interesting is that there are very few sources of independent information around some of the habitat management costs. So, you know, this is not something that the agricultural industry is necessarily that well practiced at. You know, how much does it cost you to manage scrub? What are the sort of things you're going to have to think about? What are the operations? What are the frequency? You know, how? What about neutral grassland, generating that from arable land? You know, what are the sort of things you're going to have to think about? Are you going to have to supplement your plant? What seed mix is? You know, it is quite difficult. And this is where getting a really experienced farmland ecologist, somebody who has worked with agri-environment schemes, but also other stuff as well, is really important, because that's vital to building a robust budget, because you're going to be tied to this for 30 years.
Well, yeah, and we'll come to that a bit later about the long-term nature of biodiversity net gain. But perhaps as part of this question, what do you see as the key risks to your BNG projects in particular, and how are you getting comfortable with mitigating those risks?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, before I go into the specifics of ours, it's worth thinking about how risk flows through this kind of deal. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you've got the government who's demanding a certain thing from the development sector under mandatory BNG. That places an onus on that sector, on the developers. The developers offshore that risk, or they defray that risk by buying units or creating units on site. That means the risk flows down a level to whoever's in occupation of the land on which the units are being created. The local authority don't have any risk in this game, particularly, other than an enforcement risk. And the risk of that enforcement then sits on the offsite provider. So it's worth thinking about, you know, actually all the risk accumulates like an accordion down at the bottom. Mm-hmm. Everyone else in the supply chain has either offshored or mitigated or offsited their risk. So that's one thing we thought long and hard about, is how do we account for that? And the main way that we've done it, there's two main ways. One is getting in-house ecological expertise, so that when we're operating this, we can be very sure that things are going in the direction we need them to. And if they aren't, we know about it quickly and we can respond. Doing this with an outside consultancy, we did consider, but we thought that's just, you might not get the response you need. You might get, you know, changes of personnel, et cetera, et cetera. You know, that's a risk for any business. The other thing is about pricing. And it's more than just adding a big inflation wedge on top of your costs. It's about thinking about how are you going to manage the funds that are coming in on day one? You know, what sort of approach are you going to use for that? What's your sort of treasury management type approach for that? How do you generate sufficient return to offset erosion of value over time? How do you look at potential policy changes? How do you price those in? So it's quite an involved process, and it's about being cautious and realistic, and not being overly hopeful and missing sort of obvious things that may come out and bite you in 30 years' time.
And as part of that risk mitigation, from my understanding of reading our case study on Spain's Hall Estate within the toolkit, is that you didn't opt to have a buffer. It was actually a different approach that you've taken. Is that right?
We are doing a number of things. So in terms of the spatial side of things, we are sort of building in a little bit of a buffer, but it's very difficult, particularly with the smaller deals, to build in sufficient buffer without dedicating huge amounts of land, which then become unviable. We are also using a bit of a units buffer at some points. So, you know, we aren't necessarily going to sell 100% of what we've got, certainly not on day one, even if that was an option. But the main sort of approach that we're taking is trying to find the right areas for these habitats. So it's not about trying to squeeze the most amount of BNG units, which I think generates a risk profile all of its own. If you try and squeeze, you know, you try and go for the highest BNG unit habitat on any one unit field, there is a greater possibility that you might sit there and in 15 years' time go, well, actually, do you know what? The best will in the world, we can't generate those units from that habitat because it's just not forming the way we wanted to. So it's also about having the ability to lift and shift within contracts as well. So, you know, we undertake to provide the units that are required of the habitat that is specified, but we don't necessarily tie it down to a particular area. We have the option, if it's all going wrong, at our own cost, to go and find another piece of land and to make it up by using that as well. So, you know, which we can do because we're not land limited at the scale we're operating, but maybe more difficult for others.
Is there something to talk about here specifically on how you're working with your tenants? Are they involved within the biodiversity net gain scheme that you're working to?
So we have three well, we have four farming tenants, three AHA, so long-term farming tenants, and one FBT, shorter-term farming tenant on the estate. At the moment, none of the biodiversity net gain plans involve their land.
Right.
And the reason for that isn't because I want to exclude them, but it is because I don't feel that we've got a enough experience and it, to understand what the risks are. I don't want to take something that's too risky to my tenants.
Yeah.
So we will be taking it to the tenants at the point where we feel confident doing that. And I hope when we do that, that there will be a significant value sharing element with those tenants so that it's not the landlord taking the lion's share of the income unless we're also doing the lion's share of the work, for example.
Yeah. Okay, that's great to hear, because I know we often get questions from tenant farmers on how they should start to proceed around some of these nature markets. So how do you see the projects fitting into the wider farming business thing? That's another question that we often get asked.
It's a really good question. It's a slightly difficult one for me to answer, because alongside doing the BNG, which is in the bits that we don't think we should be farming anyway, and if we are successful in securing BNG deals over those areas, then they will be more profitable than farming them. But then they weren't profitable farming them anyway, so it's a fairly low bar. The rest of the land that I have in hand, we are changing completely anyway. So we are moving from an arable farming system to a perennial farming system using trees to produce nuts. So it's a totally different, we're changing everything all at once, as opposed to trying to integrate BNG into a more conventional farming operation. But actually, the way we've set it out, it could be very easily integrated into it alongside the arable system. I've just chosen to do something else with the other bits of the fields too.
On this, we often talk about stacking and bundling of revenue streams. You've obviously taken an approach at BNG that is about flood management from the habitat creation. I'm presuming that you wouldn't also be able to sell flood management benefits to, say, your local council, I'm assuming.
So in terms of stacking natural flood management or flood risk reduction and BNG, the honest answer is I don't know. We have received capital money for a lot of the natural flood management stuff that we do. So that is basically buying beavers and fences and structures, but it hasn't had any tie to the land. So it hasn't come with any obligation, management obligations over the land. So I feel comfortable that we can glue those two streams together. So a difference between a capital and a maintenance fund is sort of easier to understand. It also means that spatially, you're actually not doing the same thing on the same place. You know, you build a fence and that fence is a linear structure and you manage the area within that fence. That is an area-based scheme. To my knowledge, there is no guidance and there is no clarity on stacking those two ecosystem services. And that's actually something we're going to be looking at with our farm cluster, trying to understand how those two might fit together more closely. In terms of stacking other ecosystem services, there are some rules around stacking things like carbon, soil carbon, under biodiversity net gain projects. That's been precluded, which I have to confess to being a bit confused by, given that they're both voluntary schemes or voluntary private schemes. So it seems a bit odd. I think there is a bit of consistency needed with the guidance between, for example, things like what can you do with biodiversity net gain and woodland creation? You know, can you take the carbon and the BNG out of it? If you can't, why not? Does it make any sense? For some schemes, you get one answer from one side and you get another answer from the other side. So I think the approach we've taken at the moment is to try and be spatially separate where we can. So we are doing BNG on one area and we are doing countryside stewardship on another and we're doing woodland creation on another. And, you know, at the point of inception, we sort of have to decide whether is this a BNG area or is it a woodland carbon area or is it something else? Because at the moment, I am not confident in the ability of us to be able to stack just simply because there's so much confusion in policy and so much confusion in practice. What I am confident in is the ability to bundle services and cost in and price in increased value to those multi-benefits projects like ours, where you can demonstrate more than one outcome, but you're not necessarily trying to sell those different outcomes to other people.
Right. That's helpful. It is a bit of a confusing period at the moment that hopefully will be cleared up in the next couple of years. So coming back to the question of longer contracts for BNG, that 30-year tie-up, can you just sort of talk to us a little bit about that? I mean, do you have plans of what you're going to do after the 30 years? Like, how would you advise farmers sort of manage that type of time frame?
Yeah, it's a constant. We get asked this so often. Again, I look at it in a fairly simplistic way, is that for those areas where we're considering entering into BNG projects or we have a BNG plan, I consider those to be theoretically permanently changed to whatever the land use is that we're moving. Now, those don't necessarily have to exclude things like agriculture, because a lot of the habitats can be quite easily managed by grazing or a limited arable or agricultural, should I say, production over those areas. But really, the first principle that I always say to people that when they ask me is, if you were happy to plant a woodland on it and accept that permanent land use change, then that's a good test as to whether BNG is for you. Because BNG can be more flexible, but it might not be. Mm. So, you know, you've kind of got to go into it assuming the worst. And if the worst doesn't happen, then you're in a better, stronger, perhaps, position you were. The one thing I can't possibly forecast is, what is the policy environment going to be like at the end of any of these BNG deals? You know, will there be an opportunity to sell the uplift? Theoretically, under the BNG rules, you can. You can go from, you know, the habitat you've achieved to another habitat that is better or better quality or whatever it is. But that relies on a certain level of consistency and long-term policy making that is conspicuously absent at the moment.
And one thing you did also mention in the case study as a impetus for doing this work is potential risk of there being enforcement down the line for land managers around some of the negative externalities that may be produced from the types of practices they're having. Can you just share a bit more about that, even though, you know, it's sort of conjecture at this stage?
Yeah, no, it is conjecture. But I think, you know, if you look at the way, to a certain extent, I think there should be. So, you know, the polluter pays principle is something that I'm fully in support of. How it's rolled out, the devil is always going to be in the detail, but I think the writing has been on the wall for the last 20 odd years that, you know, the agriculture industry, the land management industry, is going to face tighter regulation. It already is. You know, we're seeing, you know, tighter rules around what you can do around water, tighter rules around what you can do about pesticides, nutrients, etc. That's only going to get more stringent. And I think one of the things that we saw with the natural capital appraisal was the amount of soil that we were theoretically losing from our arable fields. And even if there's not a regulatory reason for us to worry about that, with all the nutrients and the pesticides that that might be carrying with it, we are just losing an asset. So even from an internal risk management perspective, something needed to be done, and something still needs to be done. So, you know, that is the only thing that keeps my business going, is that underlying asset. If I allow that to erode, then one, I'm not a very good custodian. And two, we may be left with something that is not able to produce anything or anything like what we currently do. So it's about using the asset in the best possible way and maintaining its quality in the face of a very, very challenging sort of two or three decades. We're going to be faced with a load of stuff we haven't had to deal with.
So get resilient now. That's your message if you can. Wrapping up on this point then, what's your final advice for farmers who are thinking about exploring biodiversity net gain or nature markets in general? We're still hearing a lot of this, I want to sit and wait. Others, we're sort of saying no regrets is probably baselining, but is it no regrets if suddenly the government introduces a policy where they're going to pay for baselining? So that would be a regret, I would think, if you've just walked out of your own pocket for baselining and that comes in a year. So sort of, what's your advice?
I think all of those concerns are valid. I think the one thing people can't afford to do is not even think about it. Mm. You know, with the increasing number, variety, and to a certain extent, value of offers under countryside stewardship and ELM, there are so many fewer excuses for, you know, this isn't for me. You know, I don't have any unproductive fields. I don't believe a single farmer that ever says they don't have, you know, if anybody comes to me and says, I don't have a piece of my land that isn't fully productive, you know they're lying. So, you know, therefore, everybody needs to think about this. BNG may not be the thing. It absolutely may not be. And it really needs to be the right thing for you to do. But there are a myriad of other things that you could be doing out there. You know, even if it's just engaging with some of the carbon farming approaches, you know, there's a private finance injection into supporting a transition into something that is probably going to save you money in the long run anyway. So, you know, there's a number of different levels you can engage with this stuff on. What you can't afford to do, and this goes, you know, globally, I think for anyone who's in the agricultural world, is just stick your head in the sand and go, nah, it's not my problem, because it really is.
Well, on that note, Archie, we'll leave you there. Thank you so much for spending time with us today. And as I say, if you are interested in what Archie's doing, I would suggest LinkedIn. I don't know if you're on Instagram as well, Archie, but I know that you post some amazing pictures of all the activity on the estate, especially the beavers on LinkedIn. But let us know your Instagram handle if you also have one.
Yeah, it's Spains Hall Estate on Instagram and Spains Estate on Twitter.
Brilliant. Okay. Well, thanks very much. And we'll look forward to seeing you again. Thanks.
Thanks, Helen. It's been a pleasure.
Well, that's all from us this week. Thank you so much for joining me and Archie to talk about BNG and our Milestone 5. Other audios are being uploaded and are currently uploaded to the toolkit that you can access if you haven't already through the following link, greenfinanceinstitute.co.uk/GFI Hive/farming-toolkit. But you can find all of the information that you might need on the GFI Hive homepage as well. Until next time, enjoy the rest of your day and thanks for joining us.